Friends and relatives, this is Sarah Augustine from the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery, appealing to you to join Apache Stronghold for a day of prayer on November 4, the Prayer Uprising. A Resolution Coppermine threatens to destroy Oak Flat. From the beginning of time, Apache Stronghold has grounded their resistance in the strength of their religious practice and spiritual relationship with the land. Apache Stronghold asks people of other faiths to join them in this spiritual struggle. On November 4, Apache Stronghold will amplify these intercessions into a prayer rising for the preservation of Oak Flat. Indigenous people will gather at Oak Flat to pray according to their ways, and people of other faiths will also gather to encounter the holy and to confront through prayer the forces of destruction brought by Resolution Copper. Come pray with us at Oak Flat on November 4th from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. We are praying for transformation, for forgiveness, and for healing for ourselves and the earth. Prepare yourself in prayer and plan your transportation to the sacred site located an hour east of Phoenix, Arizona, or organize prayers in your own community. To find out how to participate, please find us on our landing page at dismantlediscovery.org/NOVFOUR. If you're planning to attend the November 4 prayer rising at Oak Flat in person, we are invited to camp at Oak Flat the evening of November 3rd, as well as the evening of November 4th. The campground is free, but please bring your own tent and sleeping gear. There are also accommodations in the nearby town of Superior. To find out more details, including how to join us remotely, please see our landing page, dismantlediscovery.org/NOVFOUR. The Coalition is organizing 24-hour prayer coverage for Oak Flat on November 4th. We have a spreadsheet on our landing page. Please fill that out to let us know when and how you intend to engage, whether that's personal prayer, a prayer walk or run, singing, a prayer event, or the other ways that you pray. To sign up, you can see a sign-up sheet on our landing page, dismantlediscovery.org/NOVFOUR. Please join us. There will be people praying across the world, and we are counting on you to join us, those people of faith who are convicted to do so. We are asking people of faith traditions to pray alongside the Apache Stronghold for the sacredness of Oak Flat and all Indigenous lands and all of the earth. Specifically, we are being invited by Wenzler Nosy, Apache Stronghold leader, to pray for forgiveness for how our economic systems have harmed the earth and to pray for healing and transformation within these systems and among all people so that human and more than human kin will have a livable future. Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you there.
The Doctrine of Discovery is the current system of laws and policies that justify the removal of land from Indigenous peoples. These laws are rooted in church doctrines that originated in the 15th century.
Together, we will uncover this deep structure of colonization that systematically deprives Indigenous peoples of human rights.
I'm Sherry Hostetler, and I helped start a coalition of Anabaptist people of faith that seek to dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. I'm also a Mennonite pastor in San Francisco.
And I'm Sarah Augustine, and I also helped start this coalition. As an activist and scholar, I'm the descendant of the Tewa people and a displaced person. This is the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery podcast.
In this episode, we're going to talk with activist Dwight Metzger. He has worked with the San Carlos Apache of the Apache Stronghold for 3 decades, first on the Mount Graham Initiative and then also on Oak Flat. And he's also a radical printer, I'm going to call him, from Tucson, Arizona, who does a lot of work for labor unions and other really great organizations. And You should check him out if you have printing needs. The Glue Factory is the name of his printing business in Tucson. So welcome, Dwight.
Thank you, both Sherry and Sarah.
I want to begin by asking for you to tell us the story of Oak Flat from your point of view. How did you get connected to this struggle?
I guess I'm a little embarrassed to say I was sort of dragged into it late. I was aware of the efforts by the Arizona congressional delegation to give some public land away for a copper mine. And I knew I had friends that were fighting that legislation, which was a matter, it was years. And my friend Wenzler Nosey of Apache Stronghold was also fighting it and going to Washington with the tribal council to try to stop every effort to pass this, what was a land swap through Congress. And it seemed to be every year it would come up as an initiative, and every year this is a ridiculous notion and it would get stopped. But all of a sudden, on a late night, midnight rider, Senator John McCain was successful in getting the bill passed, the Southern Arizona Land Exchange, which gives away Oak Flat, the public land around Oak Flat, to a foreign mining company. So all of a sudden, this was a very real threat. And at that time, the activist community, allies of the Apaches, became much more energized and started showing up for the effort.
All right. And thanks so much for telling us about that. And I've heard, as you know, the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery has a working group that's been in place for several years accompanying the Apache Stronghold. And as I've been part of that work, your name has come up again and again and again. And so I know that you have been integral to some of that work in Tucson. And I wonder if you could just share with us some of your experiences. So that's the story of, you know, the 2014 legislation that has put us in the middle of this struggle for systems of life, and specifically Oak Flat, but in a larger frame, systems of life in general. And so I wonder if you could tell us about your direct experience and how you have been involved.
Thanks. You know, I said I got into Oak Flat a little more by accident or a little bit late. It was different than the Mount Graham situation, which has a very parallel story. Mount Graham is the most sacred mountain to Western Apaches. It's where their creation spirits reside. It was threatened by a telescope development by the University of Arizona, the Vatican, and other international entities. And as a young environmentalist in 1988, I was aware of this issue when I moved to Arizona. And again, a midnight rider passed, again by Senator John McCain and other of the Arizona congressional delegation, that gave this land away, this sacred site away, to foreign interests and to the University of Arizona to develop. At that point, I was, along with many other conservation groups, were completely involved, immediately involved. And that then led me to the Apaches and their struggle for their sacred mountain. At that time, in 1988, there were two fronts, I guess, fighting for the preservation of Mount Graham. A very strong, vocal, privileged, empowered white environmentalist community, and traditional Apaches who were against the telescopes but did not have voice and did not have agency and did not have a lot of trust in a political system hearing them. So their work was quieter, more underground, more spiritual, and it took a minute for the two entities to kind of converge and find commonality and trust each other by starting to work together. So I would say within a year of that rider passing, The desperation of the situation forced that coalition a little bit. It started to happen with a few Apache elders that were willing to, brave enough to speak out publicly, and then grew over time. And that's exactly been, that's where my relations with the Apache started, and this very long journey, imperfect journey of learning about each other began. It continues to this day. So, back in 1988, we were trying to fight telescopes, keep them from being developed. The original plan was for 18 telescopes to be put on top of Mount Graham. It currently is only 3. It probably will only ever be 3 because of the controversy that surrounded this development, because of the agency that the Apaches do now have. It's a different political climate and understanding that what was done there was very wrong, a very serious violation. It had all the profound destructive impacts that environmentalists predicted decades ago. They've all come true and worse. That mountain has been decimated by the deforestation caused drought and bug infestation, catastrophic fires. Global warming has amplified all of that. And what was a very unique old growth ecosystem with many endemic endangered species now is just teetering, its existence is really tenuous, right? And the telescopes have everything to do with that.
I want to just ask a few questions about Mount Graham, if you don't mind. I mean, we would love to get back to Oak Flat in a few minutes and that struggle. But when we talk about, a copper mine that is scheduled to be put in place, that is going to blow up an entire mountain and create the largest open pit mine in North America, a copper mine in North America, it should be 2 miles across is what, the mines literature says, and 10 stories deep. It just seems like such a catastrophic impact. And 3 telescopes don't seem that bad. Can you tell us what was and is the problem with putting telescopes on Mount Graham? Why is that wrong from your point of view?
Yeah, well, my point of view comes from it's always risky territory for me when I try to interpret my understanding of what this means to the Apaches. But Mount Graham being the center of their creation, where they pray, where their prayers go to the Creator, and where their creation spirits live in the mountain, to put something, to desecrate the mountain, obviously, to cut the trees and dry up the water, etc., it's a desecration. But also in the Apache cosmology, the metal of the telescopes is directly interferes with their prayers, with their ability to pray through the mountain spirits to their creators. Again, I'm probably getting a lot of this really off, but there's a specific issue with the metal, obviously with the desecration, certainly with the ownership of the land. The Vatican and U of A, they lease the land, the top of the mountain, but they've created an exclusion zone at the 10,000 foot elevation level where no one's allowed to go in, where Apaches have been, or Wensler has been arrested for going to pray, where people are not allowed to trespass yet. These giant telescopes and the white astronomers are allowed to use that for their purposes.
So if I'm not mistaken, I think the Apache, the San Carlos Apache had rights to worship in these areas through their peace treaty. Is that right?
The Mount Graham was originally part of the reservation. It was taken away for timber interests back in the day. And I'm not sure what, specifically was granted in terms of access. But it's national forest, not that Apaches ever had the same rights as U.S. citizens until maybe recently, technically, but even now they're excluded from that. So I can't exactly speak to that specifically. But, you know, in theory, American Indian Religious Freedom Act would give them access to that. But the U of A has locked them out of that. So there is a direct contradiction to that.
So just let me stop you there for just a minute, Dwight. And I wonder if you can just tell us who the three parties are that are the lessees on, once again, you said national forest land. And so who are the three lessees that are using these telescopes? I think our listeners will maybe be surprised to hear who the parties are there.
Yeah, well, it's the University of Arizona is like the landlord. They have the permit. So they saw this as an opportunity for their mirror laboratory that builds astronomy mirrors and their astronomy department to get international fame and monies by developing telescopes and then renting them out. So in the original configuration of the telescopes involved the University of Arizona and Ohio State University to build what was to be called the Columbus Project. At the time, it would have been one of the largest telescopes in the world. It was to bring on a second age of discovery. Of course, Ohio State, being from Columbus, Ohio, was part of that, and they were the money partnering with the U of A. It took them a while to change the name after such extreme public outrage over the scandal of
it. Some irony there. I mean, multiple layers of irony there.
You're talking about Arizona in the late 1980s, and that was the way things were done. And there was just, you know, I'm not defending it. It's, you know, it's a terrible racist politics here that have gotten better over time. So there, Arizona, University of Arizona is the main entity. The German Max Planck Institute has built a radio telescope. That's the second biggest telescope. They've since really pulled back a lot of their sponsorship of that because it's just not a good site for the work they want to do. And then the third telescope, the smallest one, which was the first to be built, belongs to the Vatican Observatory. And it's the Jesuit astronomers that are part of the Vatican that do astronomy in Italy. They had an opportunity to join in on this telescope. They were donated a mirror by the U.S. Air Force. It was a prototype for a Star Wars defense project. And it's just basically an extension of the work that they do at the Pope's summer residence in Castel Gandolfo in Italy that has clear skies and further that work. But the Vatican Jesuit astronomers have said they are using the telescope to look for extraterrestrial life, to see whether that could be brought within the fold of the Catholic Church. They have fought vehemently to suppress Apache religiosity. They've gone to court to say that the Apache religious views are not valid, and then goes on. So obviously very relevant to the work that you're doing. This, you know, intentional, willful taking of a sacred site and denial of indigenous rights or religious claims, religiosity is part of a pattern that's been going on for a long time.
Thank you. And thanks for, I mean, you've told us about two things that I really appreciate. One is from your point of view, what you've learned about the Apache cosmology related to Mount Graham. And then the other is sort of who the entities are, the lessees, so to speak, in that space. And so I guess I'm wondering if you could just also tell us from your point of view as an environmentalist, why was clear cutting the top of the mountain and putting three telescopes up there just ecologically, not a good idea?
Yeah, because I was just going to say, I was really actually surprised to hear that, because I was under the impression that the largest reason to oppose it was because of the way it was infringing upon the San Carlos Apache or the Western Apache in cosmology and sacred lands, but you're now saying like this was actually kind of an environmental disaster on top of it. And I don't think people associate telescopes with environmental disasters, actually.
Right. It's always billed as a clean science and something to, you know, and, you know, yeah, thanks. And I do want to go back to your other question about why this is such a big deal, this destruction of, you know, what is maybe 100 acres of forest. So for Mount Graham, the reason it was so strongly fought by environmentalists nationally is it was an intact old growth forest, a high elevation forest in Arizona. It's a top of a mountain. So the ecology is very unique. It's like being in Canada. You think of Arizona as a desert, and most of the bottomlands are desert. But at 10,000 feet, the ecology is very different. There's 14 perennial streams up there. There's thick old growth pine forest. There's endangered species that have evolved on what's called a sky island. It's an island of forest surrounded by a sea of desert. Those, particularly the mammals and other species that can't migrate, have evolved there since the last ice age in isolation. So there are many unique, called endemic species that live nowhere else that have to have that habitat. The most famous of which is the Mount Graham red squirrel. It was the most endangered mammal in North America. Its numbers have fluctuated between 400 and 90. Over the course of the telescope development is completely dependent on the old growth forest up there that has been destroyed by the telescopes and now by firefighting and bugs and et cetera from the development. So environmentalists saw this as a really, it's been also called an inland Galapagos. It's like the Galapagos Islands. It's evolved in isolation and a very unique, special biological place. It's irreplaceable. So the U of A cut into the heart of that in fragmenting the forest. It dried out the forest. It led to bugs. The trees die. The forest burns. The firefighting cuts roads in there, et cetera, et cetera. And the telescopes themselves.
So, you know, I also just out of curiosity, Dwight, and since we have you and your expertise here, I'm wondering if this has an impact on rainfall.
Yeah.
Like removing these trees has an impact on rainfall. You said there's 14 perennial streams there. And so what are your thoughts, or do you happen to know about that?
Absolutely. Locally on the mountain, it has contributed to a drying of the streams and the springs at the top. Every year, the Apaches run to Mount Graham. I think last year was the 32nd annual that they've been running to the top of the mountain, and they get the holy water from the top of the mountain. That's what they use for medicinal purposes and for ceremonies. And every year after running 100 miles, they walk up to the very top and collect the water. Last year, there was no water. This year was water. And that's what's happening is, along with exacerbated by climate shifts, the loss of the trees and the drying of the forest, it will never come back the way that it was. There may be new trees that come in, but it's never going to be the same. And it will probably never be as wet and life-giving as it once was. And if you could imagine how important that was to pre-settler Apaches in the summer to live up there where there's water and pool and game and food, that's the real loss too, is that those forests now that supported also human life are now very, very compromised. Could I take a stab at elaborating more on your one question of why is this small telescope development so important to the Apaches? Is that for the Apaches, that they're mountain spirits, as I understand, they live within Mount Graham. And they travel from Mount Graham to, say, Oak Flat, to their sacred mountains. They travel underground. And as I believe I understand Wenzler correctly, they travel through the veins of like where the minerals are. Right? It's an energetic force that moves and it's alive. And so for the Apache people, that mountain is not just a hunk of rock that they're praying to. It's actually a living entity that contains within that life force everything integral to their life force. Their being is dependent on the integrity of that whole life system. So when Resolution Copper wants to cut into and literally bear down in the earth a mile and pump out all the water and take out all that ore, the Apaches is basically lose an appendage in that spirit, that mountain spirit of one of their four creation spirits is gone, you know, is or compromised. So that's where the connection is between those and other mountains too.
Everywhere we look, we see signs that all is not right with our Earth. Extreme temperatures and weather patterns wreak havoc. Pollutants sour soils, waterways, and our very bodies, and fires and floods ravage land and communities. We believe climate change is just a symptom of a larger ecological crisis. If we want change, we must realize that the solutions to the problems we face can't come through the same systems that created those problems in the first place.
Ecological justice requires that we challenge our assumptions about creation and our relationship to it. It requires decolonization. We must turn to the leadership of Indigenous communities who struggle for all life as land and water protectors. And we are calling on people of faith to join them.
We believe this so strongly, we wrote a book about it. It's called So That We and Our Children May Live, Following Jesus and Confronting the Climate Crisis. And it's published by Herald Press.
This book offers hope for a better future alongside concrete actions for joining with Indigenous peoples to protect life and negotiate with decision makers for sustainable change that follows Jesus. In these pages, we invite you with us to confront climate change and choose life for our children and the future of our planet.
We invite you to buy our book and join the conversation. Thank you.
So one of the things I would like to just sort of consider, and I guess I'm just talking to you, Dwight, but also you, Sherry, that is it possible to, and our listeners, is it possible to just willingly suspend disbelief and say that this is true? Like maybe it's not just the belief of one people. What if this is true for us all? Mm-hmm. So Sherry, I remember visiting your church, and there was a young Indigenous woman, I believe a mentee of yours, who was praying with us, and she taught us a prayer of her people. Do you remember that? I don't know if you remember or not, but I do.
Yes, I do.
And the prayer that she taught us to pray, that she prays with her people, is thank you for this land, our body. Thank you for this land, our body. And so, you know, in our daily prayers in my family, we have adopted that prayer daily, that we begin all prayer with thank you for this land, our body, that it's not abstract, it's not a metaphor. We are part of it and it is part of us. So among my people, you know, our connection to our homeland there is that land is what makes our bodies. We are from that soil. And, you know, that soil on that precious place is made up of the remains of our ancestors, and not just the human ancestors, but the four-legged ones and the winged ones, and what I've been taught to call the standing green nation, which is all the trees and plants and everything we depend on to live. The soil is made of that, and we need it to live. And without it, we will perish. And so, you know, I mean, I think, you know, so the Apache stronghold taking a leadership in trying to awaken us to this reality with a capital R, that this is our home and we're dependent upon it, and that that decimating it in this way will cause us to perish. It's not a metaphor, and it's not just one person or one group of people's point of view, right? Like this is survival for life to be able to flourish, you know, the spirit of life that we all depend on. Yeah. And so I guess I just, you know, sorry, I'm just going on now for a minute here, Sherry. I just think, you know, this is back to that extractive logic that we've been talking about, you know, so extraction is not just about mineral extraction, right? It's seeing everything as it's seeing all of life as a commodity that can be consumed or conserved. And Mount Graham is not a commodity. It's a living being, right? So it's not to be conserved or sold at a profit. You know what I'm saying? It's a being, and our lives depend on it.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what they're saying, the message they have for us and the work they're doing. Of course, it ties into their culture, their religion, and their survival, but they're really speaking for all of us.
So, Dwight, I'm curious, like, you're not Apache, you are, you're white, you started, you know, you said as an environmentalist in this work, and how has working so closely with the Apache and coming to understand at least as much as you can their cosmology, how has that changed you, or has it changed you?
Yeah, it's changed me quite a bit. And it took a little bit of time and a great deal of patience from my Apache friends to, and such generosity from those people to let me and other people in to their ceremonies and to struggle with them. As a white environmentalist, I was very comfortable getting arrested, causing a lot of noise, getting in front of a camera, talking about the issues, doing everything it takes. And the big shift for me was to understand how important it was for us to step back, because there was another more legitimate voice that needed to be heard and really had a much bigger message that Sarah just referenced, that I think, you know, as a radical environmentalist, we kind of believe those things too. I consider myself a deep ecologist, so I believe that all plants and animals have rights too. But that's still kind of a anthropocentric way of thinking, and that the Apaches, though they're humans, really do speak as creatures that are interconnected with each other, beings that are interconnected with each other. And I think that is still something that's very problematic in the environmental world. It has not been able to evolve. You know, they talk about diversity and equity and inclusion, but has never been able to evolve out of a very colonial, even corporate approach to things, using the legal system, using the tools of the oppressor to try to change things. And for me, over the course of my evolution as an activist, I realized that this other thing was much more true to me. You know, it was important to me to listen to, and more importantly, to, you know, to step back and support. And so, yeah, that's the biggest thing for me, is to learn to shut up and to make space and to support and to be there and to be. It might be the reason why I was kind of asleep with Oak Flat when some of that litigation was happening around the legislation. It wasn't really until I was asked that I stepped up, and I'd, you know, step in as much as I am asked, and I still try to kind of hold that space. Well, yeah, I'll continue to do my work and support and make t-shirts or whatever it is, but if I'm asked to do something, I am generally going to do whatever I can to fulfill that. And I feel that's a good role for me. So that's what it's taught me over time, is where to be in relation to this.
So just to, you know, I had it as a question actually to raise with you. There has been some disquiet between Indigenous peoples movements and environmentalists historically. Those have not necessarily been easy partnerships or even folks working at cross purposes. And I think that can be confusing to some activists to try and understand that, because it feels like, oh, you guys should be natural allies. And that's not really the case. And I appreciate you articulating that.
Yeah, I don't call myself an environmentalist anymore, and even don't always call myself an activist. And the word ally doesn't really, I don't know if that always applies, but I think there's a lot of legitimate grievances for Indigenous people as to how they have been treated or largely ignored by environmental groups. Even to this day, some of the better and bigger environmental groups will fight for Native issues, but they don't have true collaboration. They're still taking the lead on it. They're raising a lot of money on it. Standing Rock was a great opportunity for Native voices to be heard. It was also a cash cow for many environmental groups. Oak Flat has some of the same attributes. You know, it's also the environmental groups that are working on it, despite the best intentions of stopping the mine, really fall short on getting involved with the Native communities and giving them leadership. And that's, I think, what's been so special about Apache Stronghold, is to kind of rise out of this and be this entity that is inclusive to those people that can kind of fall in line with a right way of doing things. It's a very open community of resistance, but it's not for everyone. It's a spiritual fight. It's not necessarily about the politics and the issues, but it's just led very differently. It's so unique. And if you look at where Oak Flat stands today as a political issue, like, there's an environmental lawsuit and it's kind of hanging out there and it really doesn't mean much. And eventually there will be mechanisms to dismiss that. But the Apache Stronghold lawsuit is what's moving and what is really now challenging the existence of the mine, whether it will be allowed to continue or not, because it is such a clear violation of religious freedom. And it's gone so much further because it's based in a type of resistance that's very different. So environmentalists have a long way to go. And this is important to me, I think, because I really believed in the environmental movement. And I still, of course, care about the earth. But I think that environmentalists sold out in the early 90s to a more formal, successful corporate structure in the early 1990s, when everybody in America was truly green. Corporations saw that and, for fear of their profits, got behind that and put tons of money into the environmental movement to get collaborative efforts to, you know, just buy this laundry detergent and you can save the environment kind of crap. When in reality, Americans really wanted change, wanted to preserve forests, and were really pushing for something more radical. But anyway, corporations stepped in, greenwashed everything, including environmental groups to a large degree, and gave them a lot of money to work on things, got them set up with, you know, pensions and 401ks and infrastructural support. And while they could do more work, they're really still working within a system that is designed, you know, to always benefit the corporations and capitalism. So that until that model changes, until environmentalists can shed themselves of their allegiance to an upper middle class lifestyle and all the trappings of that, then there's really not going to be a radical environmental movement. And clearly, more than ever, that's what we need now. And a real radical environmental movement would embrace these other things that they can't control, like an indigenous voice and a different kind of power that we, you know, we don't own. And I'm getting all over the place here. But,
well, you know, I have to say, Dwight, that you're singing our song. You're singing our song. So one of the things that we talk about, Sherry and I, is that, you know, we live in a closed system of mutual dependence. So our world is a closed system, and we're mutually dependent within it. And so this sort of extractive logic is thinking about short-term gains in an economic structure and is not really thinking systemically about the impact on all life. And so you know, I guess from my point of view, it's destined to fail because, you know, you can believe whatever you want to, but we do live in a closed system of mutual dependence. You know, that's just true.
And I'm really grateful, Dwight, because I think you really named so clearly this. I don't know that we've actually ever named it quite this clearly on our one of our podcasts about this divide between sort of white, what is now often corporate environmentalism, and in this case the Apache, but the indigenous way of looking at this. And also, you've just modeled so beautifully in what you've said how a white person can follow the people, how you can actually, you know, be converted in a way, as you put it, from this more sort of Western white environmentalism to, like, what does it really actually mean to follow the lead of indigenous people on this? And so I really thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thanks too for the work you're doing there. I know we all have our challenges to evolve our thinking and have a long way to go too. I feel really grateful, so blessed for the opportunity to work with the Apache Stronghold and other folks in this way. And I wish them all the success of turning other people on to their message. You know, I think it really does have healing possibilities for all of us. And the idea that even as colonizers, that we especially need to decolonize ourselves. It's not just, you know, that's a really important message that they bring. And we all really need that in this time here to see how we're contributing. How aspects of the way we do our work are probably directly in the way of a new way of thinking and being coming to the forefront.
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Dwight Metzger, for being with us today. What a pleasure to get to connect with you. And I want to just ask our listeners to check out the Glue Factory. The website is in our show notes for excellent and beautiful t-shirts, which we have ordered through there, I believe, and also for beautiful postcards, bumper stickers, a variety of different media. Check out the Glue Factory. This is a concern that is working for social justice, printing for social justice. And thank you, Dwight, for being the leader in your community doing that important printing work. Thank you.
Yeah. And Dwight, I would also say, I'll put the website for the Apache Stronghold in our show notes, but would that be the best way for if folks want to learn more about the struggle, both with Mount Graham and at Oak Flat, would that be the place for people to go?
That would be great. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Dwight.
Great to connect with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is hosted by us, co-produced by the DD&D Coalition and Anabaptist World.
The opinions expressed here are ours, however, and do not reflect official positions of Anabaptist World.
For more information, go to anabaptistworld.org and dofdmeno.org.
Our theme music is by Micah Peplow and Shannon Kaler. Thank you.